The next morning, Frank was in the office having a cup of coffee. He had been out earlier and had breakfast at the cafe, then returned here while Jack made the morning rounds. Frank sat at the desk with his feet propped up, flipping through the stack of wanted posters that had come in while he was gone to Arizona. The door opened and Jack came into the office, hurrying enough so that Frank knew something was wrong. He took his feet off the desk and sat up straight.
What's wrong?
Couple of hombres over at the Silver Baron jawing about how they come to Buckskin to try you out, Frank. They think they're fast guns, but they're just young and stupid, as per usual.
Did you talk to them?
Nope. Just heard about it from Vern Robeson.
Vern gets around, doesn't he? All right, I'll go see about it. Maybe I can talk some sense into their heads.
You'd be more likely to fill up a rat hole by pounding sand down it. It wouldn't be as empty as those young fellas' heads are of brains.
Frank put his hat on as Jack went to the wall rack and took down one of the shotguns hanging there.
What do you think you're doing?
Going with you, of course.
There's no need for that.
What if those varmints try to gang up on you? You'll need me to handle one of them whilst you deal with the other. But if they do that, you'll just have to kill them a mite quicker, won't you?
You're the law in this town if anything happens to me. And even at this time of day, there are probably enough people in the Silver Baron that you don't need to be firing a scatter gun in there.
And in a gunfight, I can't haul out this old percussion pistol of mine fast enough to do you much good as a partner. You're trying not to tell me that I'd be more of a liability than a help.
I never thought of you as a liability, Jack. If I did, I never would have gone off and left you in charge here like I did. It's just that I'm better suited to handle some things than you are, and vice versa.
Yeah, I'm better at being a useless old geezer.
Blast it, Jack, you're blowing this way out of proportion. You're about as far from useless as anybody in Buckskin. I could take this badge off right now and leave you in charge permanently, and I wouldn't lose a bit of sleep worrying about leaving the town in your hands.
I couldn't handle gunnies like those two in the saloon. You know it.
You wouldn't have to if I wasn't here. The only reason men like that even come to Buckskin is to try their hands against me. Now come along with me if you want, but leave the greener here. Stay out of the fight, if there is one.
Oh, there'll be one.
Jack went back to the rack and hung up the shotgun again. Then he fell in step beside Frank as the two of them started down the street toward the Silver Baron. Even after all these years, it never failed to amaze Frank how quickly word could spread of impending violence. As he and Jack approached the saloon, he saw several people gathered on the boardwalk in front of the place. More were headed in that direction. Vern Robeson was one of the men peering in the Silver Baron's front window. He turned to greet Frank with an eager grin.
Looks like there's gonna be two more notches on your gun pretty soon, Marshal.
I don't carve notches on my gun, Vern. I don't know any real gunfighters who do.
Sorry, Marshal. I didn't mean nothing by it.
I'll bet Amos is wondering where you are.
Oh, I'll go along down there to the stable in a few minutes.
Frank pushed the bat wings aside and stepped into the saloon. Catamount Jack was right behind him. The two young men standing at the bar didn't even realize Frank was there until they saw Willie Carter, the only bartender working at this time of the morning, looking intently at the door. Even then, they leisurely finished the drinks in front of them before they turned to face the drifter. Instantly, Frank saw the resemblance between them. They were brothers, probably no more than 2 or 3 years apart in age. Sleekly built, flashily dressed, handsome in a cheap way.
Well, if it ain't the Marshal.
See, Rand? I told you he wouldn't be scared of faces.
Even though he ought to be.
You were right, Brock. I figured Frank Morgan was so old that he would have lost all his guts by now.
If he ever had any to start with. Maybe he backshot all those fellas he's supposed to have killed. I mean, just look at him. I wouldn't put it past him, would you?
Nope. I reckon he was never any more than a puffed up bag of shit. What the hell's the matter with you? You gone soft in the head, Morgan?
Nope. I just heard that sort of garbage so many times for so many years that it just sounds foolish to me now. What do you reckon every would-be gunslick does when he decides to face me down? He tries to needle me into drawing, just like you two are doing. Tries to get under my skin, make me mad, make me careless. It's never worked that way before, and it's not gonna work now. But you boys go right ahead with whatever routine you worked out. You might get me to laughing so hard that it might just give you a little bit of an advantage. I don't think so, but you never know.
Why, you crazy old fart? Don't you know who we are?
He's Rand Johnson, and I'm Brock Johnson. We're the Johnson brothers.
Those names mean anything to you, Jack?
Not a damn thing. I never heard of them. But then, I can't keep up with every loco kid who thinks he's fast with a gun.
I killed Sammy Carlisle, and Brock gunned Wichita McHenry, and Pete Craig. We're gonna be more famous than Frank and Jesse James or the Daltons.
I think I sort of heard of that McHenry fella, but I ain't sure.
I saw Pete Craig in Yankton a few years back. He was a two-bit owl hoot and slow as mud on the draw. Now, Carlisle's a new one on me. He must not have been around for very long.
Quit your jabbering, dammit! You'll know who we are when you got our lead in your carcass, blast you! Now fill your hand, Morgan!
I don't want to kill you, son, but that's what's going to happen to you and your brother if you don't get on your horses and ride out of here right now. What you're doing is foolishness, sheer foolishness, and I don't want any part of it. Go find somebody else to kill you, if you're that determined to die.
Rand and Brock Johnson both grabbed for their guns, clawing the weapons out of their holsters. Frank took Brock down first.
Nobody's that fast.
That was your mistake, son. Somebody somewhere is always that fast.
Son of a gun! Neither of them even got a shot off. Not that I was expecting him to.
I imagine somebody's gone to fetch Claude Langley already. But if they haven't...
I'll take care of it.
Sorry, Willie. I'd just as soon not kill people in here if I didn't have to.
Well, it's all right, Marshal. You gave those two every chance in the world to light a shuck out of here. It's their own dumb fault they didn't.
As Frank stepped out of the saloon, the sight of a rider trotting along the street caught his attention. The man on horseback was the fella he had sent to Carson City with the wire for his lawyers in San Francisco.
Howdy, Phil. You get a reply back from that telegram?
Sure did, Marshal.
Here you go.
Much obliged.
Frank took the paper and handed Phil a Gold Eagle in turn. The man had worked as a miner until he developed a cough that kept him from spending long hours underground. He still had a family to feed, though. So Frank had him doing odd jobs and running errands such as this whenever the need arose. Frank opened the message, read it, and nodded in satisfaction.
What's it say?
Leaving immediately for Buckskin. Stop. Will arrive Friday latest. Stop. Am confident of victory. Stop. Look forward to meeting you, Morgan. Stop. Signed, Turnbuckle.
That's one of those lawyer hombres, right?
One of the best lawyers west of the Mississippi, or at least he's supposed to be. I reckon we'll find out whether he is or not. Claude Langley?
Here he comes with that meat wagon of his right now.
More work for the undertaker, Frank thought. All because two young fools had thought more of gun glory than they did of their own lives. He bet his coffee was cold by now, too. Luther Galloway's head was spinning from the speed with which he and Mr. Claudius Turnbuckle, Esquire, had departed from San Francisco. He had purchased the tickets at the train station, sent a messenger to the offices of Turnbuckle and Stafford with the information that the train on which they were booked departed at 11:30, and then rushed to his rented room to pack. He didn't even return to the office, just went straight to the train station again to wait for Mr. Turnbuckle. The lawyer arrived at 11:15 and a hack loaded with baggage. The driver, several porters, and Luther himself were pressed into service to get everything loaded onto the train on time, while Turnbuckle supervised the operation, frowning darkly and leaning on his silver-headed walking stick. They made it, barely. And then Luther had to deal with the fact that he hadn't been able to obtain a private compartment for them at the last minute. Turnbuckle and Luther stood in the vestibule of the car where their seats were located.
You expect me to ride sitting up all the way to Carson City? like a common person?
Please, sir, you said you wanted to leave on the earliest possible train, and this is it. Unfortunately, they had no private compartments available. I would have checked with you to see whether you wanted to wait for a later train, but the ticket clerk said if I tarry, these seats would be gone. Then you would have no choice but to wait.
All right. I suppose we'll just have to make the best of the situation. Where are our seats?
Right along here, sir.
The seats were on the left-hand side of the car, about midway along the aisle. They were nicely upholstered and appeared comfortable to Luther.
I'm sitting beside the window.
The Central Pacific train rolled out of the station on schedule, lurching into motion with a slight jolt. It would travel first to Sacramento, then across the Sierra Nevada mountains into the state of Nevada. Luther had determined that Carson City was the closest rail terminal to their destination. He wasn't sure how they would get from Carson City to the settlement called Buckskin, but he assumed there was some sort of coach service.
Sir, we're not likely to encounter any, hostiles, are we?
What? You mean Indians? The only hostiles still on the loose anywhere are a few renegades in Arizona and New Mexico, and maybe in West Texas. All the others have been pacified.
That's a relief, sir. I wasn't sure what the situation was.
Now, outlaws, on the other hand, well, there are still roving gangs of bandits, and they've been known to hold up trains. You can worry about them if you want to, Galloway. I took a few minutes before leaving the office to skim through the Nevada statutes regarding mining claims. Of course, I don't know the specifics of the case Morgan wants me to take, but I thought it would be a good idea to get an overview of the law.
That was a very good idea, sir.
When we get to Buckskin and have all the details, I may have to send you back to Carson City to research the law for me.
Of course, sir. I'm prepared to accomplish whatever task you give me.
You've been a good clerk, Galloway, even if you weren't able to arrange private accommodations for us on this train. When are you supposed to take your test to see if you can pass the bar?
Well, I...
Once you're licensed to practice law, there might be a place for you at the firm as an associate. No guarantees, you understand. Stafford would have to agree, and he can be a cantankerous old pelican.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate that vote of confidence.
Well, let's see how you do helping me with this case. Frank Morgan is one of our more important clients, and I don't want to let him down.
No, sir. Of course not. Just let me know anything I can do to help.
The train was still in the mountains when morning dawned. Luther peered past Turnbuckle and watched the spectacular scenery rolling past. Snow-capped mountains clawed at the very heavens, climbing high into the clear blue vault of the sky. Thickly wooded slopes formed dark green curtains. Valleys plummeted to dancing streams where fast-flowing water broke whitely on jagged rocks that thrust up from the creek beds. Luther thought he could tell, just by looking at the streams, that the water was so cold it could take a man's breath away. The train began climbing, following the steel rails that curled around the side of a mountain. Luther figured that when it reached the top of the slope, it would cross a trestle so high that looking down into the valley below would send shivers of fear through him. The same thing had happened several times already during the trip. He really hadn't been aware that heights bothered him so much until now. The steepness of the ascent meant that the train had to slow down to a crawl as the engine labored to haul the massive weight to the top. To the left rose an almost sheer wall of rock. To the right, the earth dropped away, falling several hundred feet to one of the twisting valleys that meandered through the mountains. From where Luther sat, when he looked out the windows on the other side of the coach, it seemed only nothingness was out there, and it made him dizzy and disoriented when he looked in that direction for too long. It appeared that there was nothing to support the train. It ought to fall right down the side of the mountain. So even though the view didn't amount to as much, he looked out the left-hand window beside Mr. Turnbuckle instead. The lawyer was dozing with his head tipped forward, his chin on his chest. Luther looked at the rocks now creeping by outside the window. Suddenly, movement caught his eye. A ledge ran along the slope, and a man stood on that ledge, poised as if to leap. He wore a short coat, a hat with a wide brim that was pulled down low over his eyes, and a bright red bandana that was pulled up and tied around his head so that it covered the bottom half of his face. He gripped a revolver. Luther had seen similar figures on the covers of dime novels. The man was an outlaw.
My word!
The masked bandit had jumped from the ledge onto the roof of the railroad car. The train was about to be held up. That conclusion was inescapable. Even Luther knew that one man couldn't stop and rob a train by himself, so there must have been other outlaws hidden on the slope, ready to make the daring leap onto the cars as the train crawled past. Even now, some of them were probably closing in on the engine so that they could drop down into the cab and force the engineer to stop the train. The others would be making their way into the cars to loot the passengers' valuables at gunpoint. Luther grabbed his employer's shoulder and gave it a hard shake.
Sir, wake up, sir. We're being robbed.
Everybody stay right where you are. Nobody move. Rattle your hocks and I'll put hot lead in your damn gizzard.
Luther saw the man from the ledge stalking up the aisle, a bandana over the lower half of his face, brandishing two heavy six guns now.
Cough up the loot. Now!
Put those guns down or I'll have you behind bars for the rest of your life! By Godfrey, sir! Do you know who I am?
Yeah, you're a stupid son of a bitch who's about to die.
The guns in his hand suddenly came up. The lawyer clutched at the back of a seat and tried to stay upright, but he was too badly wounded, and he slumped to the floor of the aisle. Luther wasn't the only one shocked by this wanton display of brutal violence. The other passengers were silent now as they stared in terror at the train robber. Mothers clutched their children to them, and husbands tightly embraced the shoulders of their wives as they waited to see what would happen next.
Don't be like that, dumb bastard! Stand and deliver, and maybe you'll live through this!
The bandit holstered the left-hand gun and used that hand to pull a canvas sack from behind his belt.
You, Four Eyes, take this and open it up. Get everybody's valuables and make it snappy now or I'll ventilate you too.
But...
Don't drop it!
Luther opened the bag, and with the outlaw prodding him in the back with a gun barrel, he went up and down the aisle, collecting wallets, pocketbooks, watches, rings, and other jewelry from the other passengers. Everyone cooperated. When he was finished, when the car had been looted to the bandit's satisfaction, the man turned to Luther.
Now you, Four Eyes.
I beg your pardon?
It's your turn. Empty your pockets into the bag, and don't forget that son of a bitch on the floor either. Clean him out too.
Luther followed the man's orders, taking out his own valuables and adding them to the collection in the sack. Then he knelt next to Mr. Turnbuckle's body. He lay there gray-faced and motionless, either unconscious or dead. Luther thought Turnbuckle was still breathing, but he couldn't be sure. As the outlaw loomed over him, he went through Turnbuckle's pockets, removed his wallet, took the watch and chain from his vest, slid a couple of rings from Turnbuckle's fingers. Everything went into the sack.
That'll do.
The desperado thrust his free hand at Luther, who gave him the sack.
You're so scared, I reckon I'd be doing you a favor if I put you out of your misery, Four Eyes. But you ain't worth a bullet.
With that, the outlaw turned and stalked toward the rear of the car, glaring at the frightened passengers on either side of the aisle. The outlaw vanished into the vestibule at the end of the car. Luther gradually became aware that the train wasn't moving anymore, but he didn't know when it had come to a stop. The gang of thieves must have horses hidden somewhere nearby, he thought. They probably had a hidden stronghold somewhere. The law would never find them.
Go! Oh, Galloway!
I'm right here, sir. Is there anything I can do to make you more comfortable?
Tell...
Who do you want me to speak to, sir?
Tell Frank Morgan. I'm sorry I can't help him.
You want me to go on to Buckskin, sir? After this?
Got a client. Client always comes first. Tell Morgan, delay case. Get Stafford. You can file a motion for a delay. Don't let the client down.
Buckskin. He wants me to go to Buckskin.
turnbuckle was still alive when the conductor had come through the car a few minutes later. Clearly shaken, with blood running down his face from a gash in his forehead where one of the outlaws had pistol-whipped him, the conductor had called for help and had the wounded lawyer carried into one of the Pullman cars by several porters. The passengers who had booked the compartment were forced to give it up. The fireman was also wounded, having put up a fight when several of the masked bandits stormed the locomotive's cab, and he was placed in another Pullman compartment while the conductor went to look for a doctor among the passengers. Luther stayed by Turnbuckle's side, even though there was nothing he could do to help the man. A short time later, the train jerked into motion again and finished its slow, laborious climb to the top of the pass. The conductor came back into the compartment, accompanied by a beefy man with a white beard.
This is Dr. Clemens. He's agreed to have a look at the wounded men while we get on to Carson City just as fast as we can.
Do everything you can for him, Doctor. Money is no object. This is Claudius Turnbuckle, the famous attorney.
Never heard of him, young man. But I'll do everything I can for him anyway. Sort of swore an oath to that effect when I took up doctoring.
Clemens swiftly opened Turnbuckle's blood-stained clothes to reveal the two red-rimmed bullet holes in the lawyer's chest. Clemens opened the bag he carried with him and took out a clean cloth and a bottle of something he used to swab blood away from the wounds. He leaned close to them and tilted his head in a listening attitude.
Don't hear any whistling. Means the slugs probably missed the lungs. If they didn't get the heart, or this fella'd already be dead.
You mean he's going to survive?
Oh, no, I didn't say that. He's lost a lot of blood, and there's no telling what other damage that lead might have done in there. The fact that the shots missed his heart and lungs accounts for the fact that he's still alive, but I wouldn't hold out a lot of hope, young fella. Is he your pa?
What? My father? No, he's my employer. I'm his law clerk.
Well, I wouldn't count on him making it to Carson City. Even if it does, it probably won't last much longer. Sorry, nothing I can do.
Luther felt lost and unsure of what to do next. There wasn't really anything he could do until the train reached Carson City. Once there, he could wire Mr. Stafford in Los Angeles for instructions. He was sure that if Mr. Turnbuckle succumbed to his wounds, which seemed inevitable, the body would need to be prepared for burial and then shipped back to San Francisco for interment.
One thing at a time.
Right now, Turnbuckle was still alive, and despite the doctor's dire prediction, there was no way of knowing for sure how long he would stay that way.
Well, I gotta see about that fireman. He called a slug too, the conductor said.
Yes, of course. Thank you, Doctor.
Clemens went into the next compartment, leaving Luther sitting there alone with his wounded employer. The next few hours were some of the longest that Luther had ever spent in his life. It seemed to him that the train would never reach Carson City, that he would be stuck here for eternity, growing sick from the car's swaying and bumping as he sat there waiting for Claudius Turnbuckle to die. Turnbuckle didn't die, though. His ragged breathing still continued as the train finally rolled into the station at Carson City. Ambulance wagons were sent for immediately, and Luther watched anxiously as attendants from the local hospital lifted Turnbuckle onto a stretcher, carried him off the train, and placed him in one of the wagons. The men allowed Luther to climb into the wagon, too, and let him ride along with them to the hospital. Hospital, Luther spent another hour pacing back and forth nervously in a waiting room while Turnbuckle was examined again by other doctors. Finally, one of the medicos, this one a tall, gaunt man with a black spade beard, came out and spoke to Luther.
I regret to say that Mr. Turnbuckle's condition is quite grave. The loss of blood and the shock of his injuries might well have killed him already, but he continues to cling to life. I think it's only a matter of time until he succumbs to his wounds, however.
Are you talking about days, Doctor, or hours, or...
Impossible to say. Could be days, could be a matter of minutes. I'd err on the side of hours, though.
Can you keep him comfortable?
Oh, of course. We'll do everything we can for him. And you never know, he might pull through. Miracles do occur from time to time, you know.
Thank you. Thank you, Doctor.
There was a telegraph office at the train station, Luther recalled, after he left the hospital. He returned there, walking along the streets of Nevada's capital city. Those streets were paved, and light poles with gas lights on them were placed at regular intervals. Luther passed several brick buildings with multiple stories. Carson City was no longer the rough frontier town it had once been. While it was no San Francisco, it was an outpost of civilization, and Luther felt a little better for being here. The whole incident of the train robbery had begun to seem unreal to him. But all he had to do was remember the terrible roar of the outlaws' guns and the sight of the blood welling from Turnbuckle's wounds and soaking his clothes. And it was all too real again. When Luther reached the train station, he found that his bags, as well as Turnbuckle's, had been unloaded and left there. The train itself had moved on, of course, since it had a schedule to keep, and the robbery already had delayed it. As soon as Luther had sent that wire to Stafford, letting him know what had happened to his partner, he went to the ticket counter.
Pardon me, when is the next train for San Francisco leaving?
There's one tonight, mister. You want to buy a ticket on it?
Luther opened his mouth and was about to say yes, when he seemed to hear Claudius Turnbuckle's voice, once again instructing him to go to Buckskin and tell Frank Morgan what had happened.
Mister, you want a ticket for San Francisco?
Could you tell me if there's a stagecoach or some other sort of transportation that runs from here to a town called Buckskin?
Buckskin? Sure. A stage runs down there twice a week. Is that where you need to go?
Yes. I'm afraid that Buckskin is exactly where I need to go.
Frank and Catamount Jack were sitting in ladder-backed chairs on the porch in front of the marshal's office a couple of days after the shootout in the Silver Baron. The stagecoach was due to come in pretty soon, and the two lawmen were swapping lies to pass the time until its arrival.
Ever fight any Comanches while you were down there in Texas as a yunker?
Yeah, right after the war while I was cowboying. We had to take some cows to a ranch up in the Panhandle. That was some years before Mackenzie broke the Comanche spirit by destroying their horse herd at Palo Duro Canyon. So the boys who were going on the drive knew we might run into trouble.
That didn't stop you, though, did it?
Oh, of course not. We were young, full of piss and vinegar. We were actually looking forward to the idea that we might wind up in an Indian fight. I reckon we thought we were going to live forever, the way most kids do.
Just out of curiosity, you know how many of that bunch is still alive?
Well, out of the dozen who went along on the drive, two, I think, counting me.
Oh, ain't hardly forever, is it?
Nothing is.
You were saying about the Comanches?
Yeah, we were southwest Amarillo, not that far really from the spread we were going to, when they jumped us. Came out of nowhere like they sprouted from the ground. Them and their horses, too. To this day, I don't know where they were hidden. But there they were, and they were whooping and hollering so that the 300 head we were driving stampeded. One of the fellas got caught in front, couldn't get out of the way. His horse went down and we lost him then and there. The rest of us managed to make it to a draw where we forded up.
What about that stampeding stock?
Oh, we let it stampede. Figured it was more important to save our hair first.
Reckon that makes sense. Them Injuns charge you?
6 or 7 times. We lost another man, had a couple wounded, but they lost a dozen or more and finally decided it was going to cost them too much to roust us out of there. So they took 6 of the cows and rode off.
So they killed 2 of you cowboys and lost 12 of their own men, all for 6 cows?
That's right. They were kind of scrawny critters, too.
Now, tell me how in the hell 6 cows is worth all that killing and dying.
They're not. What was worth the killing and dying to them was the fact that we were there to start with, and they didn't want us there.
How about you and the fellas with you?
We were young and stupid. That was enough.
What'd you do, bury the boys you lost and then round up the cows and go on?
That's exactly what we did. That's what we were being paid to do.
Frank was glad when he heard the stagecoach was coming into town and stood up. Jack did, too.
Are you still expecting that lawyer fella on today's stage?
I haven't heard any different since that telegram he sent me.
They walked along the street toward the stage station, and as they approached, they could see the cloud of dust boiling up from the hooves of the team and the wheels of the coach as it reached the edge of town. The Jehu hauled back on the reins and brought the vehicle to a perfect stop in front of the station. The coach, still painted a fading red and yellow from its days of service with the Butterfield line, swayed back and forth slightly on the broad leather thorough braces that ran underneath it. Catamount Jack lounged against the hitch rail while Frank planted his feet, squared his shoulders, and waited for the passengers to climb out of the coach. The driver and shotgun guard leaped down from the box, and the guard reached underneath the seat to pull the mail pouch out of the compartment there. A little frown appeared on Frank's face as the doors of the coach remained closed and no one emerged from it.
No passengers this run?
Oh, there's a passenger in there, all right. I reckon he's feeling a mite poorly, though. Didn't take to all the bouncing on the trail. Had to hang his head out the window a few times between here and Carson City.
Frank walked over to the coach and grasped the handle on one of the doors. He twisted it and pulled the door open. Slumped on the forward-facing seat inside the coach was a man in a dusty brown suit and hat.
Mr. Turnbuckle?
The passenger turned a pasty, washed-out face toward the sound of Frank's voice. He was much younger than Frank expected, with spectacles on his nose and a thatch of sandy hair under the expensive hat.
You, need a hand? Give me a hand here, Jack. Mr. Turnbuckle doesn't appear to feel too good.
They reached into the coach, got hold of the new arrival, and helped him out onto the street. Frank tried to be careful about it, but there was no way to avoid some jostling. Still, Turnbuckle seemed to feel a little better once he got his feet back on solid ground.
That's the worst ordeal I've ever endured. Every bone in my body aches, and I think all my teeth have been shaken loose.
Yeah, that stagecoach road's a mite rough, all right. You'll get used to it, I reckon.
No, not in a million years.
Listen, you are Claudius Turnbuckle, aren't you?
Yes, I'm Claudius Turnbuckle.
I'm Frank Morgan. I'm the fella who sent for you, Mr. Turnbuckle. But in this case, I'm not your client. If you come with me, I'll introduce you to him. Jack, can you see about getting Mr. Turnbuckle checked into the hotel and have his bags taken over there?
Sure. Don't worry about a thing, Marshal.
Frank took hold of Turnbuckle's arm and steered the lawyer's unsteady steps toward the office of the Lucky Lizard Mining Company.
I told you in my telegram that this business concerns a mining claim, but not one that belongs to the Browning Mining Syndicate. It's the Lucky Lizard Mine. My friend Thomas Woodford owns it, and his claim to it is under attack from an hombre I suspect is a crook of some sort.
Lucky Lizard.
That's right. The tip's office is right up here, and he can tell you about it. That's what they call Woodford.
Let me get this straight. You want me to help a man who owns a rival mine?
Well, I reckon there's plenty of silver in these mountains for all of us.
That's an unusual attitude in business.
My son Conrad would agree with you. He'd heard rumors that there was a potential problem with one of the mining claims in this area and came up here to make sure it wasn't the Crown Royal. That's the Browning mine.
Yes, I know.
Anyway, when he found out that the trouble didn't have anything to do with our mine, he thought we ought to just stay out of it.
That seems like a sound business decision.
The problem is, I'm not much of a businessman. I never have been. But I am Tip Woodford's friend, and I wasn't going to let him face this alone. Anyway, I've run across skunks like this hombre Bratton before. If he gets away with stealing the Lucky Lizard out from under Tip, he's liable to get greedy and go after one of the other mines next. And it might be the Crown Royal he sets his sights on.
You want to stop him now before he can try to hurt anyone else?
You don't stand around watching a rattlesnake to see if he's going to strike at somebody before you shoot him. You know he's going to sooner or later, and then an innocent person is going to get hurt.
I don't suppose I can argue with that.
Want a drink, or maybe a cup of coffee, or something to eat before you talk to Tip?
Perhaps some coffee later on, but right now, nothing.
All right. Here's the Lucky Lizard office.
They stepped onto the porch in front of the office, and Frank opened the door. He ushered Turnbuckle inside. There were two desks in the office. Tip sat at one of them, Diana at the other. Both of them stood up as Frank and Turnbuckle entered.
Here he is, the famous Claudius Turnbuckle.
Welcome to Buckskin, Mr. Turnbuckle. Frank here tells me you're one of the best lawyers west of Mississippi. You'll need to be, because that fella Bratton is smart and dangerous. Reckon it'll take all your legal expertise to give him his comeuppance.
Tell me all about it, Mr. Woodford.
Luther had intended to tell Morgan who he really was while they were walking down the street to the offices of the Lucky Lizard Mine. But then Morgan had begun telling him about the case, and despite the fact that he still felt terrible, Luther found himself getting interested.
Here's your story. This fella, Dex Brighton, showed up in Buckskin a while back, said that he was the rightful owner of my mine. He said that his pa and the fella I bought the claim from were partners, and they had an agreement saying they could only sell out to each other, not to anybody else.
Have you actually seen this so-called partnership agreement?
Brighton's playing his cards close to the vest. He won't show anybody the document. Says he'll produce it for the judge, but not until then.
That's his right. Although I might be able to file a motion as soon as the judge gets here, compelling Brighton to produce his evidence. Litigants in a civil suit have more leeway about such things than, say, the prosecution in a criminal proceeding, but still, the judge might see things our way.
Do you really think you can win?
Of course we can win. I can tell already that this man Brighton has no real case other than his word and a mysterious document that will probably turn out to be a complete fake. Once I've demonstrated that to the judge, Brighton will be exposed as a swindler who's trying to cash in on all the hard work you and your father have done to turn the Lucky Lizard Mine into the highly successful operation that it is, Miss Woodford. In fact, I think I should pay a visit to this man Brighton right now, just to let him know that he's in for a fight. Who knows? Perhaps when he sees the sort of opponent he's up against now, he'll decide not to pursue this spurious claim at all. He might just abandon the idea and leave Buckskin.
You really think he might lie to Shuck?
Leave town, like you were talking about, Mr. Turnbuckle.
Oh, yes, I think there is indeed a chance that Mr. Brighton might light a Shuck. We won't know until we try, will we?
Brighton's got a room over at the hotel. We'll see if he's there.
You plan to accompany me, Mr. Morgan?
Yeah, I think that'd be a good idea.
Very well, then. Let's go confront Mr. Brighton. Mr. Woodford, Miss Woodford, don't worry about a thing. Claudius Turnbuckle is on the case.
I feel better already.
So did Luther, except for the part of his brain that was still trying to convince him that he had gone totally, irrevocably mad.
Is this man Brighton dangerous? Physically dangerous, I mean.
I got a hunch he can be. He and Tip got in a pretty bad ruckus a few days ago. Tip's a tough old bird, but I think Brighton would have hurt him pretty bad if I hadn't stepped in and put a stop to it. To make things worse, I had to arrest Tip because Brighton filed a charge of assault against him.
I could defend him against that charge as well.
Well, you'll lose if you do. A lot of people saw him throw the first punch. I'm not saying that he wasn't provoked, but he started the ball. Reckon the judge will probably fine him. Maybe sentence him to a night or two in jail. Tip can handle that. This business about who really owns the Lucky Lizard is the real case. That's where we need your help.
And you shall have it, to the best of my ability.
Nobody can ask for more than that.
When they reached the hotel and went into the lobby, Frank spoke to the desk clerk.
Mr. Brighton in his room?
His key's not here, so I assume he is, Marshal. Room 27.
Much obliged.
A few moments later, Frank knocked on the door of Brighton's room. He glanced over at Turnbuckle as he did so, and again he saw a flash of nervousness on the lawyer's face. It disappeared as soon as the door was opened, though. Dex Brighton stood there with his coat off and his collar loosened. He had a drink in his hand, and when Frank looked past him, he saw the bottle on the table next to the bed. Brighton wasn't drunk, though. His gaze was too keen for that.
Hello, Marshal. What brings you here? And who's this?
I'll tell you who I am, sir. I am Claudius Turnbuckle, attorney at law, and I've come to Buckskin to expose your scheme to obtain the Lucky Lizard Mine through fraudulent means.
Is that so?
Yes, sir, it is.
So this is that bulldog of a lawyer you called in, Morgan. I've got to say that he's a little smaller and younger than I expected.
I don't reckon it matters how big you are or how old you are in court. As long as you've got the facts on your side.
You're awfully quick to assume that I don't.
If the partnership agreement you have is genuine, why don't you go ahead and produce it? Why didn't you show it to Thomas Woodford as soon as you came into Buckskin? The two of you might have been able to settle this matter without ever taking it to court.
I offered to settle with Woodford. He threw me out of his office.
You didn't show him the document?
That paper is staying in a safe place until I'm good and ready to use it. Anyway, if Woodford wouldn't take my word to start with, why would he believe the partnership agreement was real? He would have just claimed it was a fake, like he's saying now.
Am I to understand that you intend to prove in court the document isn't a fake?
I don't give a damn what you understand or don't understand, Turnbuckle. And I'm sure as hell not going to tell you what I intend to do. What kind of fool do you take me for?
A greedy one, sir, who has overreached with his scheme to steal the Lucky Lizard Mine from its rightful owner.
And you'll have to prove that in court, Turnbuckle. Until that time comes, I don't think you and I have anything else to say to each other. If you came here hoping to arrange a settlement, you failed miserably.
I would never advise a client to settle with a thief. Good day, sir.
With that, Luther turned and stalked off down the hall toward the stairs.
Where'd you find that little banty rooster, Morgan? He's not going to stand a chance once my lawyer gets through with him.
Just who is your lawyer?
Desmond O'Hara.
Don't reckon I heard of him.
You will have by the time this is over, Morgan. You will have.
Frank jerked his head in a curt nod and followed Turnbuckle. The lawyer was already halfway down the stairs. Frank caught up to him in the hotel lobby.
So, that's our opponent, eh? I agree with you, Mr. Morgan. Brighton is a ruthless, dangerous man. You could see it in his eyes. But no man is bigger than the law. He'll be cut down to size once I get him in the courtroom.
For Tip Woodford's sake, Frank hoped that Turnbuckle was right about that.
Gents, I'd be pleased if you have a sit with me.
That evening, Frank and Luther were in Woodford's study in the big house on the outskirts of Buckskin where Woodford and Diana lived. Woodford had had the house built during the first silver boom when the Lucky Lizard originally made him a rich man. The boom had collapsed. Woodford had lost his fortune, and his wife had taken their young daughter and gone back east to live, leaving Woodford to cling stubbornly to his faded hopes and dreams. Then, just a few years ago, Diana's mother had passed away, and she had returned to Buckskin to live with her father. The big house had fallen into disrepair by then, although Woodford was still living in it. The discovery of a new silver vein had changed everything, and Woodford was once more a rich man. Diana had taken charge of the household and seen to it that things were put back in order. Frank had told Luther about Tip Woodford's history that afternoon, after Luther had rested for a while in his hotel room. Morgan had come to the hotel to inform Luther that Woodford wanted both of them to have dinner at his house that evening. Even though Luther was still exhausted from the grueling trip from Carson City, he hadn't hesitated in accepting the invitation. It would give him a chance to discuss the case some more with Woodford, and it was exactly what Mr. Turnbuckle would have done in this position. Besides, dining at the Woodford house meant that he would have the opportunity to spend more time with Diana Woodford, and that prospect was definitely appealing to Luther. He'd always had an eye for a pretty woman, and Diana had an elegance and grace about her to go with her physical beauty that Luther wouldn't have expected to find in a frontier settlement such as Buckskin. They hadn't talked about the case during dinner. Diana had lived in St. Louis, so she was familiar with cities, but she had never been to San Francisco and wanted to know about it. Having grown up there, Luther knew all about it and was more than happy to spin tales about the city's history and describe its attractions. Morgan had been to San Francisco on numerous occasions and knew most of the places Luther talked about. Dinner was over now, and the men had withdrawn into Woodford's combined study, library, and office.
Tell me everything you can remember about Jeremiah Fulton. I want to know how you met him, anything he said about his background, how it came about that you bought his mining claim from him. You understand, Mr. Woodford, that any detail, no matter how small, may turn out to be the vital piece of evidence in our attempt to derail Brighton's claim. Unless, of course, it turns out that the partnership agreement is blatantly false, in which case that will be all we need to bring this affair to a successful conclusion.
Well, all right. I'll try to remember as much as I can, but it's been a while back. I met Jeremiah Fulton in a Virginia City whorehouse. I ain't proud of some of the things I've done, Mr. Turnbuckle, but I won't deny them either. I'm as human as the next fella, and always have been. But I don't want to hurt Diana's feelings.
Don't worry, sir. I won't share any details with your charming daughter except the ones that are absolutely necessary.
Anyway, I ran into Fulton in the bar at his sporting house, and since we were both prospectors, we got to talking. You know, telling each other about places where we'd look for gold and silver, places where we'd had a little luck, and them where we hadn't had any.
Of course.
Fulton told me about this spot that he swore was a natural for silver. He'd had him out of education and said all the signs were there, the right kinds of rocks and stratification and such like. But he'd sunk a couple of shafts and hadn't found a thing, so he decided he was wrong about it and was wasting his time.
This was the claim that turned out to be the Lucky Lizard?
That's right. Fulton had filed on it with the land recorder, all proper-like, and he said he'd sell me the claim if I was interested in giving it a try.
Why would you be interested in prospecting a claim that hadn't panned out?
You know the answer to that, Frank. Fellas like me and old Jeremiah Fulton, too, for that matter, I always think that we're luckier than the next fella, that fate's gonna smile on us and we're gonna be the ones to find the strike. Anyway, Fulton sounded like he knew what he was talking about with all that talk about geology and such, so I decided to take a chance. He sold me the claim for $20.
Such a small amount.
Well, Fulton was flat broke. He just spent his last coin on a drink. And $20 would buy quite a bit of what the place we were in had to sell, if you know what I mean. That was all Fulton was interested in right then.
So he was really just trying to promote enough dinero to take one of the girls upstairs?
Yep. And I came out of it with a claim that made me a rich man. Not once, but twice.
At any time during this conversation you had with Fulton, did he make any mention of having a partner in this claim?
He didn't say a blessed word about that. He didn't mention anybody named Chester Bratton.
You remember that clearly, even though it's been years since the conversation took place?
Fella tends to remember things that have a big effect on his life. Nothing's ever had a bigger effect on mine than buying that claim.
What about finding the silver on the claim? How did that come about?
Well, that's the best part of the story. I had just about as much luck as Fulton did at first, namely, none at all. I was about to give up on the claim, too. I didn't figure I could even sell it to some other poor, deluded fool and get my $20 back. And I saw this little lizard run up into a crack in the rocks. And for no real reason, I looked to see where he'd gone.
And that's where you found the silver vein?
Yep. Come up almost to the ground. It was pure luck I followed the lizard to it, though. So when it came time to name the mine, I knew what I was going to call it.
Thank you, Mr. Woodford. You've given me several ideas for approaches we may take in our legal efforts. I'm still confident that we're going to emerge from this affair victorious.
I sure hope so. I've lost one fortune already, Mr. Turnbuckle. Don't reckon I could stand to lose another one, especially not for Diana's sake.
Miss Woodford doesn't need to worry. Claudius Turnbuckle won't let either of you down.
Luther didn't even have to remind himself this time that when he spoke of Claudius Turnbuckle, he meant himself. He wasn't going to let them down. Especially not Diana Woodford.
Better luck next time, boys.
Dex Brighton stepped out of the top-notch saloon and turned toward the hotel. He had played poker for a couple of hours this evening and come out almost $100 ahead. He was passing the mouth of an alley when he heard a voice from the shadows.
Psst. Boss! Hey, boss!
Quickly, Brighton glanced around, saw that no one on the street was watching him, and stepped into the darkness of the alley.
Damn it, Stample! What are you doing here?
I just wanted to let you know that all the boys finally got here, except for Deuce Dooley. And he ain't gonna make it. He come down with a bad case of lead poisoning over in El Paso. Damn fool tried to draw on Falcon McAllister. Asa Perkins told me about it when he rode in this evening. So I reckon we're ready to grab that mine whenever you get word. There's 18 of us, all good men. That's more than enough to handle a bunch of old miners.
I told you, Stample, we're not going to attack the mine and take it over that way. Only as a last resort. I still think I can convince Woodford to sign it over to me peacefully.
I don't know about that, boss. Old timers like this fella, Woodford, are usually pretty damn stubborn.
He'll come around to my way of thinking, especially when he doesn't have Frank Morgan as an ally anymore. I want you to draw Morgan out of town so that you and your men can get rid of him. Maybe some trouble at the Crown Royal would do it. Morgan and his son own that mine. Take care of that before you deal with the judge coming into town on that stagecoach next week.
Sure. We can handle that. Morgan's gonna die this time. I guarantee it.
I hope you're right. Once Morgan has been dealt with, there'll be just one more thing I need you to do. Woodford has a lawyer now, a man that Morgan brought in from San Francisco. He doesn't look like much, but he has quite a reputation. Yes, once Frank Morgan is dead, I want you to kill Claudius Turnbuckle.
Garrett Claiborne had brought the latest mining techniques with him when he began supervising the operation of the Crown Royal Mine, and as a result, it had become quite profitable. when Tip Woodford's discovery of a new vein in the Lucky Lizard had prompted Conrad Browning to order that the Crown Royal be reopened and explored more extensively, Conrad had hoped for a modest success. Claiborne had delivered much more than that, locating a particularly rich vein deep in the mine. The ore coming out of the Crown Royal these days assayed just as much silver per ton as that from the Lucky Lizard, and a little better than what the Alhambra mine was producing. Conrad was pleased, and he didn't mind telling Claiborne as much. The two men sat in Claiborne's office at the mine, going over the assay reports for the past month. Rebel was back in Buckskin. Conrad had driven out here alone in the buggy early this morning while the dew was still on the grass.
You've done good work here, Garrett. Excellent work.
Thank you, sir.
Clearly, I made the right decision when I hired you to be the Crown Royal Superintendent. How long do you think the mine will continue at this level of production?
Oh, that's impossible to say, Mr. Browning. The vein could run out tomorrow, for all we know. I will say this, though. At this point, the vein shows no signs of ending. It's as solid as ever.
That's a good, honest answer. Stay with it as long as you can. And when it does run out, we'll see if we can find another one.
Would you like a drink before you head back to town, sir?
Conrad pulled a gold turnip watch from his pocket and opened it to check the time before he answered.
It's late enough, I suppose. I wouldn't mind.
Claiborne got up and went to a filing cabinet, opening the bottom drawer to take out a bottle of whiskey and a couple of glasses. He splashed a couple of inches of the amber liquid into each glass and handed one to Conrad.
To the Crown Royal's continued success.
Indeed. Whew. When do you plan to head back east?
I don't really know. I'd thought that we might start back before now. But Mrs. Browning seems to be enjoying herself out here so much that I hate to ruin her fun.
Oh, she's originally from New Mexico territory, is it?
Yes, that's right.
Well, I hope you'll stay out here as long as you want to. I know that Mr. Morgan enjoys your visits.
He does he? What the devil?
They started for the doorway at the same time. Conrad was closer, so he reached it first. When he stepped outside the porch, another shot blasted out.
Damn it!
Claiborne had followed closely behind him. The mining engineer grabbed Conrad's collar and hauled him backward. The two men stumbled into the office. Claiborne kicked the door closed.
Sorry about handling you so roughly, Mr. Browning.
No apologies necessary, Garrett. I was a damned fool for running out there like that before I knew what was going on. You probably saved my life. Could you tell what was happening?
Well, I didn't get much of a look, but from what I saw and heard, several men are firing from the trees down slope, just spraying lead around wildly. Sounds like they're still at it.
Claiborne hurried over to a gun rack on the wall and reached for a Winchester. A few of the bullets struck the log walls of the office building, but didn't penetrate them. The gunmen were probably shooting at the stamp mill and the mine entrance, too, judging by the amount of powder they were burning. Claiborne went to one of the windows and pushed up the pane, crouching low so as to keep out of the line of fire as much as possible. Conrad started to follow him, but Claiborne motioned him back.
I'll see if I can get a shot, sir.
Claiborne edged the Winchester's barrel over the windowsill and risked a look. Then he swiftly brought the rifle butt to his shoulder, nestled his cheek against the smooth wood of the stock, and began firing.
Whoa!
He had to duck back down as a bullet shattered the window pane and sprayed glass over it.
Well, I seem to have drawn their attention. But the men in the stamp mill are returning their fire, too. I don't know what those bushwhackers hope to accomplish. If they're trying to waltz in here and take over, they're going to have a big fight on their hands.
Claiborne waited a moment, and then rose up and opened fire again, sending several more shots toward the places in the trees where he had spotted powder smoke rising. This time, there wasn't any response. Claiborne ceased fire and waited.
The only shooting is coming from the stamp mill now.
Do you think it's safe to go outside?
Yeah, better wait a few minutes just to be sure. Those varmints could be trying to trick us.
Gradually, the fire from the stamp mill died away too, and the eerie silence that always followed a gun battle hung over the mine headquarters.
Wait in here, sir.
Claiborne pushed the door open with the barrel of his rifle. When there were no shots, he stepped outside. Conrad followed far enough to see the stamp mill and saw men armed with rifles emerging from that building, too. Claiborne hustled over to join them. A short time later, a group of men headed for the trees to see what they could find. Conrad watched with interest. The searchers returned a short time later and spoke to Claiborne, who then returned to the office.
Yeah, the bushwhackers took off, all right. The men who went out there found shell casings in the tracks of their horses. But if any of the riflemen were wounded or killed by our fire, the others took them with them when they pulled out. That's about what I expected. They wouldn't want to leave anyone behind to possibly be identified.
Who could they have been? Indians, perhaps?
Not around here. The Utes and Paiutes who live in the area have all been pacified and haven't caused any trouble for quite a while.
Outlaws, then. Maybe they thought you had a payroll on hand and intended to steal it.
Then they would have tried to get into the office here and take us by surprise. Oh, it doesn't make any sense. It was like they started shooting willy-nilly just to try to shake us up and do whatever damage they could.
Well, whatever they were up to, I know someone who can probably figure it out.
I was just thinking the same thing. We need to go tell Mr. Morgan what happened.